Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast in the New Books Network. My name is Derek Litvak, and I'll be your host. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Brandon R. Byrd about his book, The Black Republic, African Americans and the Fate of Haiti, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2019. Dr. Byrd is Assistant Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. The Black Republic examines the multitude of attitudes towards Haiti in the post-Civil War period. Following emancipation, Black leaders across the nation either looked to Haiti as an example of Black self-determination or held concerns over whether the nation should stand out as an expression of what Black governance looked like. Byrd's exploration of the complicated intellectual history surrounding African-American leaders' relationship to Haiti sheds new light on an earlier period of Black internationalism. Dr. Byrd, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
All right. So I guess to get things started, can you give our listeners an idea of what got you interested in this project and why you felt that you wanted to look at this?
So I always say that I stumbled upon it by accident. During my junior year, senior year of college, actually the period in between, I was entering into this honors program for history majors. And as part of that, you had to complete a senior thesis. And for mine, I wanted to research Charles Clinton Spalding, who was a Black North Carolinian and is most famous for leading the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company for basically the first half of the 20th century. And during that period, North Carolina Mutual was the largest Black insurance company in the nation. And so I was really interested in him as a Black leader in a place that was really the epicenter, if you will, of the civil rights struggle in North Carolina, and how he sort of navigated those politics. And part of a large part of that interest is that I'm from North Carolina, so it was really a pursuit of a topic that was not only, you know, quote unquote, historically important, but also had a real sort of personal tie-in. And lo and behold, in his papers, I stumbled upon this trip he took with a number of other Black leaders of his era to Haiti. He went there in 1937, so right after the U.S. occupation of Haiti. And that was very unexpected. And it led me to ask a number of questions about, you know, why did Spalding pursue these connections? Why did he, in his words, want to throw up a highway between the Negroes of the United States and those of Haiti? Just what was going on there? What was the background, the foundations of that interest in Haiti? What were the ideas that motivated him? And so from there, eventually going to grad school, first at William & Mary, then UNC, decided to try to pursue those questions to broaden out from beyond this sort of story about Spalding to one about how Black intellectuals and activists writ large conceptualize Haiti and why they conceptualized it in the ways that they did.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's always a really cool thing when, you know, people can kind of get into history that's sort of around them and, you know, finding someone like, you know, Spalding, who's from, you know, the area that you grew up in and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know for myself, when I was in college and everything like that, I'm from Virginia, and I kind of got into my area just by studying, you know, George Mason, because everyone in mm-hmm. Virginia absolutely loves George Mason for some reason when it comes to slavery. And so I think that's really cool in terms of, like, you know, for any aspiring historians out there, like, you know, you don't have to just stumble across something in some dusty room or everything. Like, look around mm-hmm. you. There's plenty of history.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. And so I guess for people who are less familiar with this history, can you tell our listeners, you know, give them a brief history of, you know, Haiti up to the point that your book starts and sort of the U.S. relationship with this country?
Yeah, for sure. Both Haiti and the United States, they're born in a similar moment. They're born in, you know, the age of revolutions. So they have broadly speaking, simultaneous, but definitely divergent births, right? The United States is a slave-holding republic. Haiti is a product of an anti-slavery and an anti-colonial revolution. Those differing origins certainly shape the relations between the two, not only from their very beginnings, but then throughout their histories, right? I guess the things that may be most familiar to readers are the ways in which diplomatic relations between the two countries throughout most of the 19th century are in a very literal sense non-existent. The United States refuses to recognize Haiti, basically from Haiti's birth in 1804, the end of the Haitian Revolution, until 1862, until the Civil War, when you do not have this critical mass of white Southerners fighting to block the recognition of Haiti. And that policy of non-recognition is certainly indicative of larger ways in which Haiti occupies this very peculiar place in the U.S., in the white U.S. imagination, occupies a place as a black country, and black as being, you know, spectral in a sense, right? That it looms over U.S. politics, it looms over U.S. culture. In a way that it embodies at times some of the worst fears of, say, white planters in the U.S. South, right? Now, there's certainly a history, too, when we talk about relations between Haiti and the U.S., we have to talk about relations between Haiti and Black Americans, too, right? At the same time that perhaps most famously for folks like Thomas Jefferson, Haiti looms over their imaginations in this spectral sense. It's certainly, for much of the 19th century, it's inspirational. It is aspirational for African Americans as a place where slavery was overthrown, as a place where Black folks achieved independence, right? It occupies for African Americans a no less important place in that political imaginary, and so that's really the sort of background where I begin with in the book. Now, with all that said, I'm very much interested in a period that's a bit lesser known in the relations between Haiti and the United States. This late 19th, early 20th century moment where the U.S. emergence after the Civil War as an industrial, self-imagined power, very much interested in consolidating its control in the Western Hemisphere. And at that moment, Haiti really exists at the nexus of not only U.S. thinking about race, but also U.S. imperialism. You know, to make that more concrete, before the U.S. occupation in 1915, U.S. warships are basically off the shores of Port-au-Prince on a yearly basis. It's a time period where, to quote historian Rayford Logan, where Haiti goes from being a pariah to being a prize for the United States.
And so during the beginnings of diplomatic relations, as you were talking about just now, you know, it goes from, you know, a non-existent relationship to something that kind of just is, you know, quite sudden in a certain sense. And so how does this, you know, new diplomatic relationship between Haiti and the United States kind of factor in to the beginnings of your story that you're telling here? And how does the response by Black Americans to the beginning of diplomatic relations between Haiti and the U.S. sort of introduce a sort of kind of divergence between some Black leaders and other ones that you kind of study throughout the book?
Yeah, I think the word that I'm hearing you get at there that's really critical here is official recognition, right? Because there had been certainly for much of the 19th century, there had been a great deal of commerce between the U.S. And Haiti. There'd even been some less formal diplomacy between the two. Historians like Ron Johnson show how even early U.S. Presidents, including John Adams, had entertained the formation of diplomatic relations with Haiti, right? But in 1862, with that granting of formal official recognition, that has enormous meaning to African Americans. It's a recognition that African Americans see as really speaking to their own concerns, not the way to put it. It's an act. That act of formal recognition is something that African Americans see as being possibly analogous to their own recognition as a free, self-determining people. So put another way, the acknowledgement of Haitian independence, finally, at last, to African Americans could be a portent of a similar recognition of themselves as a collective free people emergent from slavery, right? If Haiti could be recognized on an international scale as an equal nation, as a sovereign nation, as part of, in the parlance of the day, of the sisterhood of nations, well, then wouldn't Black Americans, you know, be recognized as U.S. citizens in more expansive terms as self-determining people, you know, able to dictate their own institutions, to own their own land, own property, to dictate their own futures, right? So put simply, that official recognition, it really is a central part of this moment of possibility in 1862-63, moving forward into 64-65, the end of the Civil War, right? It is on par with the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation, with the surrender at Appomattox, with the end of the Civil War, with all of the happenings that seem to augur a brighter future for African Americans, right? And you can, we can understand why, we can see why there would be that that significance attached to it, right? For generations, Black Americans, they had looked to Haiti as this model Black Republic, as a singular Black Republic, right? So when the status of the singular Black Republic changes in a positive way, seemingly, African Americans are going to attach even greater significance to that, right? Now, as you point out, you know, that's the sort of the symbolism, the abstract nature of it. There's more complexity to it. There's complexity when the Haitian diplomat shows up, and African Americans, I argue, of all classes, are very interested in literally greeting him. And, you know, there's not necessarily a reciprocal relationship, right? There's complexities when, you know, there is very clearly this formal recognition, but rhetorically, white Americans don't lend Haiti any more respect in the 1860s, then the 1870s, and they did in the 1820s or 1840s, right? And so then African Americans have to grapple with, what do they do with that, right? What do we do with this imagined relationship to Haiti when Haiti also exists in the white imagination in, you know, far different terms, right? How do we, as some African Americans put it, how do we manipulate that?
And I think for me, you know, when I was reading over this, you know, I'm just, and when you're speaking about it just now, I'm kind of really struck by, you know, just the kind of, when you think about just like how revolutionary this would have been for a lot of people during this time period, you know, you're talking about a nation where America had not had, you know, an official diplomatic relationship with. And then during the Civil War, you know, after, you know, the kind of the war is taking this turn where it is becoming something about slavery. And suddenly, you know, the kind of lone Black Republic is finally being recognized. And I think, you know, particularly for historians and, you know, people who are familiar with this time period, it's so easy to kind of have a cynical lens of like, we all know what's coming. We all know this whole kind of, you know, vision for a better future does come eventually crashing down on Black Americans. But, you know, I kind of, when reading it, I'm just like, I'm struck by just how much, you know, there is this possibility for kind of a brighter future. And I really like how you develop that in the book.
Yeah. And I tried to just dig down into the micro, if you will, right? Of course, Washington is, among African Americans, is a very diverse, wartime Washington is a very diverse population, right? You have sizable camps of freed people would flock there from, you know, the surrounding environments. You had an established class of, you know, what we would call Black professionals in Washington, right? And I think for all of them, right, we can, as best we can, right, we can try to imagine what it meant when you literally have Black folks. You have the Haitian minister and his cabinet showing up to official functions in Washington, D.C., sitting down with the political elite of Washington, right, advocating for a Black state. I mean, that's, as you put it, I mean, that's monumental, not only in sort of a abstract political sense, but in a very like literal sense. You know, people, you could see that. You could see where the Haitian diplomat lived. Right. Black Washingtonians could see that. They know where he goes to mass. You know, unfortunately, he doesn't go to the Black Protestant churches as number of African Americans would have liked, but they know where he's moving around DC, right? And where he's moving is both in a literal and a non-literal sense. Where he's moving are places where African Americans had not been, right? As you put it, there are possibilities there. There are different futures that are embodied by that Haitian diplomat, that are captured, that are encompassed by the diplomatic recognition of Haiti.
And I guess moving on to, you know, another big sort of, you know, event when it comes to Haiti is, you know, the idea that kind of comes about in America of, you know, expanding and annexing Haiti, which along and the Dominican Republic, which I think a lot of people who don't study this history probably don't even know exist. I know I only found out about this, you know, probably earlier this year when reading other books, and I was kind of dumbfounded because, you know, there's so many parts of this history that were obviously just never taught in school. And so, you know, what were the responses by Black Americans to, you know, the kind of calls by some people to annex and expand into, you know, the Black Republic?
Yeah. So I'll preface all this by saying one thing that we have to remember that I also try to be cognizant of is exactly what we talked about in the previous question, is that there is some optimism in this moment, right? There's certainly apprehension too, right? At the same time where, you know, the political status of African Americans is changing, you have massive and violent white backlash to, for instance, Black voting in the South, to Black attempts to gain property ownership in the South, right? So there's optimism and apprehension, right? But with that optimism, right, you know, there's a feeling among some Black intellectuals and activists that this is a new United States, right? That this is a reborn United States, that with the defeat of the slave power, with the defeat of the Confederacy, that this is a United States that can be born, reborn on these founding principles of equality, human equality. It can be reborn on the principles of racial egalitarianism, now encoded in a revised constitution, right? And so some of that influences attitudes towards expansion and annexation. Perhaps the most impactful case, if you will, would be Frederick Douglass, who's probably at the forefront of promoting these ideas of a United States that was reborn, or at the very least could be reborn on these egalitarian principles, on these Republican principles. And so for him and a number of other Black intellectuals and activists, U.S. expansion could be a force for good. Now, that to annex Haiti and the Dominican Republic could be a way of helping to modernize those countries, that it could be a way of bringing other Black people under a government in which they could be full-fledged citizens, that they could be part of a great democracy. Now, a lot of those attitudes are also premised on some assumptions about Haitians, for example, right? They're premised on some assumptions that, you know, Haiti could use some modernization, right? That it could use the influence of the United States, right? Those assumptions come through pretty clear in the writings of, for example, Benjamin Tucker Tanner, right? A future bishop of the AME Church, editor of the AME's Christian Recorder, for whom expansion and annexation are not only tied up into these ideas about what this reborn United States could become, but they're also tied up into very much these religious sensibilities, a real sort of crusading spirit, where by exporting not only U.S. industrial strength, cultural values, religion, Black people, Black Americans could not only benefit Haitians, but they would also be, in some sense, fulfilling their missions as good Christians, as good Protestants, right? So the long or the short answer would be that there's a whole lot of complexity on these opinions about expansion, annexation during this period of Civil War Reconstruction. And these attitudes on expansion, annexation of Haiti, they are certainly tied up into broader hopes. They're tied up into broader aspirations. They're tied up into broader apprehensions during this just absolutely tumultuous era.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so when we're thinking about, you know, the kind of, you know, official responses to Haiti and kind of the official relationship that is building here, one of the things that you talk about is why and how important kind of these official diplomatic positions are for African Americans trying to go to Haiti. And, you know, I think most people could kind of imagine like, oh, like people want a title or people just want an important position, something like that. But you kind of you go into like why these positions are actually meaningful beyond just those kind of baseline, you know, kind of surface level, you know, aspirations, why they would be important for Black Americans during this time period. And so can you give our listeners a kind of idea of why that is?
Yeah. So I'll say that there is definitely some, there is some part of the attraction of these positions is definitely that they are good paying positions at a time when even for the most prominent African-Americans, and really we're talking about Black men here, even for those most prominent Black spokesmen, well-paying positions, they're not exactly, you know, falling off trees, right? So to get what's called the Haitian plum, to get that position, there's very clear material benefits, right? But you're absolutely right. And what I do emphasize in the book is that beyond that, there's greater value attached to it. That diplomatic post in Port-au-Prince. That, for one, it being basically the highest federal position for African Americans, it's a way to affirm Black people's place in U.S. politics and public life. It's a place to, and this is something that Black diplomats routinely say in their applications for the position. Ebenezer Bassett, the first Black diplomat in U.S. history, says this before as he's applying for that post in Haiti, that this will affirm African Americans' new status in the United States. And in many ways, it does, right? That these Black diplomats to Port-au-Prince, that they are members of the federal government, something that was unimaginable for most of U.S. history, all of U.S. history before that period, right? So there is real value beyond that. There's real value beyond that just material gain for that individual diplomat, right? There's a material value for Black folks as a collective, right? Even beyond that, I will say that many of these diplomats, they really hope to direct U.S. foreign policy when they're in Haiti. We could talk about whether once they're in that position, how much ability they have to curtail U.S. empire. But they did not imagine themselves as unthinking tools of the U.S. state, right? They really do hope to serve the U.S. They do not go there with the intention of undermining the U.S., right? But at the same time, they do hope to benefit Haiti, right? They want to be fair to Haiti. And to a slightly lesser extent, they also go there with the understanding that to be fair and equitable to Haiti, to help it deal as an equal on the international stage with the United States, would also benefit African Americans. That they have the understanding that as Haiti does well materially, as its international standing rises, that will only benefit African Americans in the United States, right? So there's just massive importance of that diplomatic position in Port-au-Prince, right? It takes some historical imagining, it really requires a shifting of our perspective to really get at why that was so important. We have to remember that this is the era before decolonization in Africa. This is the period before Black diplomats are going to go anywhere other than Haiti, Haiti and Liberia, right? So it's to reiterate just the language that African Americans use to talk about it, this is the Haitian plum, right? It is the definition of a plum position.
And, you know, in terms of talking about how, you know, these diplomats and people, just everyday people as well, are trying to kind of, you know, change perceptions about Haiti. One of the things that you talk about is this thing called the Haitian Republic controversy. Mm-hmm. And so could you briefly explain what this is to our listeners? And then how does this influence the kind of perceptions of Haiti? Why is this mm-hmm. important during this time period for how Haiti is viewed in America and, you know, as you say, both among Black people, but also kind of in the white imagination?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just. I'm thinking about how to boil a complex diplomatic crisis down, into a response that won't take all day. So basically,
yeah, I can understand that.
The Haitian president at the time. This controversy occurs in 1888. The Haitian president, Lysias Salomon, he's overthrown. Basically, he is viewed amongst a wide swath of Haitians, particularly among the Haitian professional class, Haitian elites, as being corrupt, as trying to make himself as the president for life. So after he's overthrown, a struggle for power ensues, and two main contenders for the presidency emerge, two generals, Florville Hippolyte and François Legitime. Now, the crisis is indicative of a trend, not only in that period, but a recurring trend throughout Haitian history, and that is foreign meddling in internal Haitian politics. Hippolyte is backed by the United States, who's eager to see him power, believing that he will be more receptive to U.S. Business and government interests. For his part, Hippolyte had made some very vague statements, expressions of being willing to cede some territory to the U.S. These are very vague. Legitime was backed by France. Okay. In backing Hippolyte, the U.S. government also it essentially is in cahoots with this steamship operator named William P. Clyde. Clyde is the one who's funneling arms and munition to Hippolyte. One of the ships being used to funnel arms to Hippolyte is called the Haitian Republic. Okay. Understandably, Legitime seizes the Haitian Republic, knowing that it's funneling arms to his rival. Okay. The U.S. press immediately cries out. Okay. This is an affront to U.S. power. It's an affront to this emergent U.S. empire. It's an affront because the country that has seized the Haitian Republic is a black country. And so the language is very much racialized about how could Haiti do this? You know, they're essentially calling Haiti and Haitians uppity. So for many, and this is not something that we just see in retrospect, it's obvious at the time that many in the black press that they immediately identified the racialized dynamics at play here. They immediately recognized that as the State Department formulates its response, that this is a response that is going to be heavy-handed because Haiti is a black country. The black press, as they condemn the actions of the State Department, basically in recovering the Haitian Republic, that they identify Haiti as really existing at the nexus of U.S. racism and U.S. empire. They draw parallels between Haiti's situation and the situation that African Americans in this post-Reconstruction era are finding themselves in, as being subject to wanton violence, as being subject to a different form of justice, right? And so it really solidifies for many black intellectuals and activists, and I emphasize the black press here, it really solidifies this idea of Haiti as being a site where one could really identify the threats to black sovereignty, to black self-determination on an individual, collective, even national level. It really solidifies this really fundamental idea at the heart of black internationalism of solidarity, transnational solidarity, the pursuit of common cause, right? It solidifies that that idea too, that that were it not for U.S. interference, that that Haiti could potentially fulfill its potential for lack of better words, right? So there's all that happening. I'll add too that most immediately the Haitian Republic crisis is the precursor to Douglas's diplomatic tenure. So Douglas, Frederick Douglass, is the most famous African-American diplomat to Port-au-Prince in this era. And when he goes there, he is going there in the aftermath of the Haitian Republic crisis. And what he is asked to do is to basically secure for the United States Haitian territory that the U.S. government says Hippolyte promised to the United States for funneling arms and ammunition to them. So there's a lot going on there, right? What I argue is that this is it may be an overlooked moment in U.S.-Haitian diplomacy, right? But it is one that really encapsulates a lot of broader themes and the histories between the United States and Haiti, Haiti, the United States, African Americans in Haiti, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, when, you know, kind of looking at this history and the way you present it, and you kind of talked about this in your answer just now, it's just, you know, how much, you know, Haitian history and then African American history is really kind of, you know, kind of it encapsulates or not encapsulates. Let me put that again. Let me try that again. You know, when you're talking about this, one of the things that kind of strikes me about, you know, this whole affair and kind of Haitian history in general and African-American history in general is just how much of it is kind of wrapped up in, you know, the kind of U.S. nation state always kind of getting in the way and trying to get its own way over what other people want, particularly, you know, in this case, whether it be Haitian black people or African-American black people in the nation. In one way or another, it's always the United States sort of trying to get its own way over, you know, what these people want.
Yeah, I would agree. The U.S. government and the U.S. government is. So try that again. The U.S. government and U.S. business interests, which are increasingly intertwined in this moment in the late 19th, early 20th century, that they feel that their wants should dictate Haitian policy, Haitian governance. I argue that that is inarguable. For one sort of data point, William P. Clyde, who I mentioned as being that steamship operator funneling arms to Hippolyte, he not only is the proprietor who owns all the steamships that that are basically plying this route between Haiti and the United States, he is the legal client of the U.S. Secretary of the Navy. So when the U.S. Secretary of the Navy argues that to secure Haitian territory, to secure access to ports is critical for U.S. military interests, he is also speaking for William P. Clyde, who says that to have access to these ports is very critical for my business and U.S. private business interests. And the same is true vice versa. William P. Clyde argues that we need X, Y, and Z for U.S. capital in the Caribbean. He is voicing the interests of the U.S. Secretary of Navy, right? Strategic interests, the interests of U.S. capital. These things are inseparable.
And so, you know, you've mentioned Frederick Douglass already, but to take another kind of black intellectual that I think many of our listeners would be familiar with is Booker T. Washington. And one of the things that you talk about in your book is the Negro problem, as it's called during this time period, and how Haiti is a part of that. And then when it comes to Booker T. Washington, how he thinks about both the Negro problem and Haiti. And so how does this, you know, kind of complicated relationship between, you know, this African-American intellectual, you know, this kind of larger cultural force of kind of racism in America and in Haiti kind of work itself out during this time period?
So the Negro problem, and I draw a lot on other scholars who've written about this, Khalil Muhammad, for example. The Negro problem is it boils down really to this idea, this question that really pervades white American discourse. Could African Americans exist in freedom? Could they exist as part of a modern industrialized society? Right. And the basic premise of that question is that, of course, that African Americans are a problem, that they are a disconcerting and aberrant part of U.S. democracy. Right. What do we do with them as a free people? We knew what to do with them as enslaved people. What do you do with them as a free people? Now, where I push this forward is to show the international dimensions of that idea. Right. For many white Americans, and I say many of these are these are learned men, right? These are Nathaniel Southgate Schaller, Harvard scholar, right? Haiti supposedly proved the basic premise of the Negro problem. It supposedly proved that Black people could not thrive in freedom. It supposedly proved that Black people could not exist independent of white control. And to make that argument, they would write and say all sorts of wild things. They would write that, Haiti before the Haitian Revolution, it was not only a very prosperous place, but slavery there was very benign. It was easy. And we know that mortality rates, they outstrip birth rates in pre-independence Haiti in Saint-Domingue. It was one of the most brutal slave societies in the Americas. Haiti, when it sits at the center of this discourse, the Negro problem, both in a material and abstract sense, it becomes very critical for Black intellectuals at the turn of the century. For Booker D. Washington, for example, if Haiti became, in his words, a respected Negro nationality, then it would disprove the claims of white Americans. So he recruits Haitian students to Tuskegee. And many Haitians are eager to come to Tuskegee. They see it as a great opportunity to uplift themselves. He believes that to export the politics of a racial uplift, to really ensure that Haiti could produce for itself, that it could achieve material prosperity, that it could achieve an economic independence, that its international stature would improve, and then by extension, African Americans' stature would improve as well. So Booker T. Washington, he is far from being alone in this. He really applies this idea that material and moral improvement and also representation matter as an antidote to racism. He really extends that to his thinking about Haiti. As I write, like, this is conservative in many ways, of course, right? If you argue that material and moral improvement, that representation, that these things are antidotes to anti-Black racism, right? That really misses the real causes of anti-Black racism. But this sort of, this international dimension of racial uplift politics is also based on an assumption that national identity did not close off diasporic belonging, right? In fact, it's actually premised on a potentially very subversive idea that the fates of African Americans and Haitians, that the fates of Black America and Haiti were linked, right? Potentially, that's a very subversive idea.
And, you know, kind of going on to, you know, another kind of big black intellectual during this time period, W.E.B. Du Bois is someone that you also speak about. And, you know, I really found his views on the U.S. occupation of Haiti, which you've mentioned before, very interesting, especially when you kind of contrast those, contrast what we usually think about Du Bois to Booker T. Washington as, you know, two people who are constantly in conflict. And one of the things that I kind of really found surprising, not knowing this history before reading your book, was that, you know, you would think Du Bois would kind of be right from the start, you know, the U.S. should not be meddling in Haiti and all of these things. And you kind of are shedding the light saying, not so much, you know, this, as in all things that you're looking at, is much more complicated. And so can you give our listeners an idea of like what's going on here and how Du Bois's own ideas about Haiti and the Haitian occupation kind of change over time?
Yeah. So you're right. And that is the logical sort of a presumption that we scholars, also lay people, would have, that Du Bois immediately would say no to the occupation. But that just wasn't the case, right? The occupation we know really begins on, it is based in the racism of very influential U.S. politicians, including the president at the time, Woodrow Wilson. It is based on the interests of U.S. capital. The National City Bank of New York essentially owns the National Bank of Haiti, right? It is based on U.S. imperialism. It is based on strategic interests, right? The U.S. Navy is very concerned with potential German encroachments in the Caribbean during the World War I era. So it's based on all that. And black intellectuals, they see some nuance there. Many of them, including W.E.B. Du Bois, wonder at the outset whether potentially U.S. intervention may stabilize Haitian politics in what was a very tumultuous era for Haitian politics. Some of them wonder if it potentially, a U.S. intervention in Haiti may be an opportunity for African Americans, right? If they direct this U.S. intervention, well, then maybe they can make it effective and productive for Haitians rather than detrimental. Maybe they can affirm their place in U.S. politics and public life at a time where, of course, Woodrow Wilson is closing off opportunities for African-Americans in U.S. politics and public life, right? So there's a lot of ambivalence, right? Al Du Bois, to your point, he changes his tune on the occupation, right? Certainly by 1920, due to Haitian resistance to the occupation, due to African-American investigations of the occupation, due to his contacts with Haitian activists, he comes around and builds an understanding of just how devastating the occupation of Haiti was. He really begins to understand that this occupation in no way is benefiting Haiti, that the U.S. is censoring the Haitian press, that it's instituting forced labor in Haiti, that it has rewrote the Haitian constitution to make that constitution conducive to U.S. Capital, right? It allows foreign property ownership in Haiti, for example. Du Bois comes around to an understanding of how the U.S. Marines are killing thousands of Haitians, right? And he becomes very vocal about all of these things, most notably in the crisis. And as he becomes a spokesman for the anti-occupation cause, he really positions Haiti at the center of a very expansive and very radical understanding of Black liberation, right? The Haitian struggle against the occupation is an anti-racist struggle. It's an anti-capitalist struggle. It's an anti-imperial struggle. So as Du Bois espouses these internationalist politics in common cause and solidarity with Haiti, he's espousing, what I try to show is this radical Black internationalism that, of course, extends far beyond Du Bois, but of which Haiti is it's a cornerstone.
And so, you know, we've kind of kind of had something in my throat there. Let me start that over. And so, you know, we have this great book in front of us. You know, we've given the listeners, you know, an idea of what this history looks like. And I think, you know, for some of the listeners, you know, they might not have had any idea that any of this was going on. And I think, you know, this is a very kind of highly readable book, in my opinion, and will really be an eye opener. And so, you know, I really encourage our listeners to go out and buy this. Again, it's The Black Republic, African Americans, and the Fate of Haiti. And so can you give our listeners an idea of what you might be working on after this book? And I know it's just coming out, so if you want to tell me that I'm just taking a break for a little bit, that is a completely fine answer.
So up next, I'm working on a family history. So one of the main figures in the Black Republic is James Theodore Holly, who leads a mass migration of African Americans to Haiti during the 1860s. Once in Haiti, he becomes a Haitian citizen, and he also becomes the first Black bishop of the Episcopal Church. So this history will begin with James Theodore Holly and his brother, move to two of James Theodore Holly's children, who become prominent Black intellectuals and activists in their own right. They become Garveyites, for example, and end with one of James Theodore Holly's grandchildren, who becomes a influential agronomist in post-occupation Haiti. So it's a family history that I really hope to get at. It's sort of broader social history of migration, internationalist politics, to get at a really dynamic and dialogic history between Haiti and the Atlantic world. So it's a book that I'm excited about. You know, it's a little ways off, but hopefully folks can hang tight and maintain some interest in my writing.
Well, I'm sure that they'll be mulling over this book for a little while. And then, you know, once you have that book out, I'm sure we'll have you right back onto the program. But in any case, thank you very much for coming onto the program today, Dr. Bird.
All right. Well, thank you, Derek. I really appreciate it.